Good morning. For those of you who are participating in this retreat by way of tape, I'd just like to let you know where we are. We're in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Franciscan Renewal Center, August 1986. And with a wonderful group of about 100 people who are making this retreat. Let me say a couple more words about retreat, then we'll pick up where we left off last night, which was the circus and God, which are basically the same. Retreats are special. They're gifts. Not everyone gets to make one. Very few people in this world today slow down to take enough time to reflect about who they are and why they're here and what this is all about. I'm 49 years old, and I can't tell you how much in awe I am of what I'm still learning. You know, I think the whole thing's going to be over with before I catch on. And that's exciting, because there's still room for growth, and we'll be talking about that this morning. But if you want to make a good retreat, the most important attitude to have is openness, to realize that you don't know it all, and that basically you wouldn't want to. Some of you have known, or know, some know-it-alls. And you know what they're like. They're not the kind of people that you invite to your parties. They're not the kind of people you go to when you're in trouble. They're not the kind of person that you really trust, because they know it all. And because they know it all, and because we know enough to know that they don't know it all, there's distrust there. And there's illusion. There's a small pamphlet that is very popular around Al-Anon circles called Acceptance. It's written by a man named Collins, who I happened to meet before he passed away. A wonderful person. He also wrote a couple of other little pamphlets, just I'll mention briefly. One is called Partnership, and that's about relations. The other one is Grief. And it's really important when a loved one passes away that you face into that grief process and be aware of some of the dynamics that are involved in that. Grief is something you can't prepare for a whole lot, but you need to be present to when it goes on, because it's the new teacher, and it's the new class. And it's not the class that you had before, because the grief always relates to someone or something new. Alcoholics should be involved in grief early in their sobriety, because they're really grieving their best friend, alcohol. Some of you know my friend Father Terry Ritchie. He talks about his drinking behavior in this particular way, which I can't identify with completely. I identify with just a little bit. It didn't happen to me that much. And drinking patterns vary widely. But Terry claims that alcohol never really made him happy. It just gave him the illusion that in about 10 minutes he was going to get real happy. But still, it was his best friend, because it brought that potential with him. Now, it worked a little different for me. I got real happy. When I used to drink, I used to get smart and brilliant and kind of an authority on all kinds of things. And I used to get inspired. And I'd listen to the country western songs. And I would play those over and over on the record player. And, you know, Eddie Arnold, Make the World Go Away. And Peggy Lee, Is That All There Is? And then I would make it my personal mission to someday meet Eddie Arnold and Peggy Lee and bring the good news to them and shape them up so that they could enjoy life as I was at the time. And I would take copious notes about great books I would write and lectures I would give. And there was a problem in that. The next day when I looked at the notes, I couldn't read them. And I remember on a couple of occasions trying to drink enough to get back to that state where I could decipher the notes. And my best recollection is that each time I overshot. But I do remember being the kind of person that had the feeling that everything was okay and that whatever it was, I could handle it, and if I didn't know the answer, I'd have it soon. Those are wonderful feelings. You know, it's too bad they were so temporary and clouded with poor memory. You know, the way most of us were brought up educationally, we were taught that if you want to get good grades, and we're all looking for the good grades, we're looking for the A's, or if you're a real old person and you lived in Arizona a long time ago, you look for ones. Ones were the same things as A's. Anyway, the way you got a one, or the way you got an A, or the way you got to be successful was on examinations you came up with the right answers. And if you were cunning and had any ability along the lines of being manipulative, it didn't take you long to psych out a teacher and find out what they wanted on the test and talk to some people that had taken the course before and come up with the right answers and get the A's. It was real embarrassing for me a couple of years ago, or a few years ago, when I looked at my college transcript and I went into shock. It was good news and bad news. I got an A, or I got A's, in a course called epistemology. Now, it's wonderful that I got the A's, and I was excited about that. But the sad part was, I don't know what epistemology is. I just have a vague general idea. And really what I was doing was just, you know, feeding back what I thought that person wanted. I learned how to do that. And my memory time span or retention period was about 2 weeks after the test, and then it all left. What a sad story that is. And yet a lot of us go through life trying to impress others or impress ourselves long enough to be approved or to be labeled successful or okay or to get the A, and then it all disappears and it all evaporates. And what do we have left? All we have left is a lot of exhaustion and fatigue and a sense of having wasted a lot of time and energy and emptiness. It's paradoxical that the basic thing that you need to grow spiritually is that same emptiness. Because if we're all full of our old ideas and our own ideas, there's no room for anything else. So I'd like to make the point as we begin this morning, and for those of you new with the retreat, is that questions are okay. Questions are wonderful. And the more questions you have, the more exciting and alive your life is going to be. So it isn't coming up with the answers. If you cherish and nourish and look for and try to foster questions in your life, something wonderful happens. You not only come up with answers, you come up with new questions. New questions you didn't have room for before, or new questions you wouldn't have thought of on your own. So it's okay not to know it all. It's wonderful not to know it all. Because you think about it just for a little bit and you realize that only one person knows it all. And some of you know, because of my sharing with you, that I took a real good run at being an atheist. You know, in reflecting back on that whole episode, I have to realize that my problem was not so much that I wanted to be an atheist. I just wanted God's job. It wasn't that I didn't believe in him. I wanted to do what he does. I wanted to run things. And I was upset because he got there first. I have big plans for all of you. Even those of you listening on this tape who I haven't met yet, you'd faint if you saw my plan for you. I seem to have a plan for everyone except me. And I stumble around trying to discover what that is. But there's a simple way to find out what that is. Some of you who are present here know who I'm talking about and make it even more humorous. But I might as well introduce this idea right now. I want to talk about something that usually isn't talked about, and that's the ugly people in the group. I have a good friend named George, and George and I used to work close to each other, at least close enough, so that we could have lunch together on a weekly basis. And one week it would be my turn to choose the restaurant. The next week it would be George's turn. And every time it was my turn, I chose a restaurant in Phoenix called Bill Johnson's Big Apple. And I love that place because it's down home, barbecue food, healthy food, cheap. Waitresses dress up like cowgirls and wear guns and say y'all, and there's sawdust on the floor. And if you're into self-pity, it's a great place to be. Anyway, George doesn't like Bill Johnson's Big Apple, and he was upset every other week. And one week we were in there and just got seated when I looked at George and he had pain written all over his face. Just absolute pain. I said, "What's the matter, George?" And he just shook his head. I said, "I know. You don't like this place." And he lit up and he said, "You're finally catching on." He says, "I can't stand this place." I said, "What's the matter with this restaurant?" He said, "Well, it's full of ugly people." Well, that's kind of gross. We don't talk that way. But I looked around, and sure enough, George was right. And not only was he right about there being some ugly people there, there was one lady who was world-class ugly. And we tried not to look at her, and the more we tried not to look at her, the more we caught ourselves peeking and caught each other peeking. And pretty soon we're laughing, and the tears are coming down our cheeks because we're embarrassed that we're thinking this way, and we just can't believe how strange this creature is that's eating next to us. When the waitress came, we couldn't even order. We had to point at the menu so she knew what was going on. For a long time, George and I never told anybody about that. But we went back again in 2 weeks, and sure enough, there were more uglies there. It seems to be the local meeting place. And it became a joke between George and myself, and we discovered uglies elsewhere. I mean, they're everywhere. There are a couple on this retreat. There's one sitting on your right, and there's one on your left. There's an apprentice sitting right between them. Anyway, what happened in George's life and what happened in my life at this particular time was we were both helped enormously by individuals that we didn't think were going to help us. You know, we got the answer to a big problem delivered as a gift from someone who we would not put on a list of people that we thought could help. In my case, it came from someone who didn't even know that he was helping me. And George and I nicknamed those folks the ugly people, the unlikely ones. So we developed a great affection for the ugly people. And I'll tell you, if you really get into ugly watching, you can go back to that restaurant, but the best place, no matter where you live, is to go to a state fair. There are people who live underground all year long. They come out once a year and they go to the fair. And that's where you find them. Now, there's a secret movement going on in our society today. I'm going to draw a big circle here on the board. And at the bottom of that circle, I'm going to draw a line, maybe including about 10 or 15 or 20% of that board. Included in that group of people, if the circle represents everybody on Earth or in our world or in our life, those people down on the bottom we'll just call the dregs. Those are alcoholics, those are drug addicts, those are gamblers, those are compulsively obsessive, nervous, fuss budget, pious, religious, fanatical kinds of strange people. We'll just call them the uglies. These are the folks you hope don't buy the house next door. Wonderful thing is happening today. A lot of them are getting over being that way. A lot of them don't have to drink anymore or overeat. A lot of them don't have to gamble compulsively. A lot of them don't have to use drugs. A lot of them who live with other ugly people don't have to let the other uglies ruin their life and rule it for them, which is usually what happens when you love someone like that. They wind up, maybe I'll get into a little family system theory as we go along here. I've learned a lot about it. A general principle in any family system, regardless of whether there's a lot of health or a lot of sickness, there is simply this. The most dysfunctional person emotionally, whoever that is, and if you're an alcoholic, you probably win the contest, huh? The most dysfunctional person emotionally in any family is the one that gets most of the emotional power. Now that's crazy making right there. You know, you don't need a whole lot else to stay goofed up with. And one of the kinds of power that people like that receive is they receive some kind of an emotional power over other people where everybody else is kind of on hold. It's kind of like they have to check with, in our case, let's make the dysfunctional person the alcoholic. You ask the average family member how they feel, and if they were going to be real honest with you and truthful, they would say, I don't know, I haven't checked with my alcoholic yet today. You know, because he or she's calling all the shots. And what happens in family situations like that is you lead secondhand lives. Secondhand lives. So maybe an agenda item for our retreat or a goal we could have to look at would be to examine the ways that we have lived life secondhand. And a topic related to that would be how many values are in our life that are hand-me-down values that we operate on and have integrated into our life and make decisions because of that were really handed to us by our parents or a church or a teacher or somebody else that we've not examined, that we've not really owned, that we've just accepted and operated on. And if you take a good look at that, you're going to find out that there are a lot of things. Maybe before the retreat's over, I'll find a little piece of literature about a fellow that talks about this wonderful time in his life when he suddenly discovered that he didn't like salad. And he realized that the reason he ate salad and ordered it at every meal because his father was some kind of a health nut. And it was expected. And his father had been dead for several years. And the guy was sitting in a restaurant and just ordered a salad. And he looked at it and he screamed at the waitress, take the damn thing away. He was liberated. You know, he suddenly realized he didn't have to eat salad. So on the retreat, he could look for all the salad you've been accumulating over the years by way of old ideas or hand-me-down ideas. Now, the wonderful thing about these dregs or these ugly people is that they're everywhere. Everyone is ugly. We've talked about it a lot on retreats that I've given. And an amazing thing kind of came out of it. It's awkward to talk this way, and it's a sensitive subject. But some women are strikingly beautiful, and some men are very, very handsome. And there are some folks who just have a lot of sex appeal and charisma. And if you get those kinds of people sharing on a rather deep level, you find out that a whole lot of that, which a lot of us value a great deal, perhaps unwittingly, maybe by hand-me-down values, a lot of that is really imprisoning. It's a real trap. And it's real hard to know who your friends are. It's like being wealthy. You're never sure. I mean, if you're poor, you don't have any doubt about who's your friend or not. Okay. Well, if you're ugly, your friends are obvious too. And a couple of these real, I'll just say, beautiful people have shared with me and with groups that I've been involved in what a trap that is. Now, there's nothing wrong with looking good and taking care of yourself and having some respect. And I'll promote all of that. But like anything that's beautiful or worthwhile, we can overdo it. And if all you become is some kind of charade or front or image and there's nothing behind it, you get lost. One of the greatest ways to get lost is to become an alcoholic because you don't have a clue who you are. You've got several roles. And for those of you that blacked out, it even got more confusing because someone walks in the room, you vaguely remember them, he says, my God, when I was with her, who was I? I think I was a bank president or a jet pilot. I don't know what. And that raises the stress level right away when you're trying to figure out who you are, right? And keep it all sorted out. It's okay if you can separate people and deal with one at a time, but if you get three or four of them together in the same place at the same time, you go crazy. Back to that little grief pamphlet. One of the things that was said there, and I quote it not accurately, but just give you the summary, is that grief isn't all that bad because it helps you realize what you value and care about in life. And it says, show me the kind of man or the kind of woman that you go to when you're really in trouble, when you're hurting, when you need advice, when you look for wisdom. And when you look for that kind of person, you always find one trait in common. They've all suffered a lot. They all, in one way or another, have become painfully aware of their own ugliness. And they've faced it and dealt with it and accepted it. And one of the ways that they've done that is to realize that they don't know it all and that they really wouldn't want to. There's a wonderful cliche familiar to members of Al-Anon and also Alcoholics Anonymous. You hear it more around Al-Anon people, but it's let go and let God. And I'd like to add a thought to that cliche that has helped me a great deal, and that's let go and let God be God. Let God be God. He does a much better job than we do. I mean, we get too serious about it. And He has a sense of humor. You know, I can prove that to you. If you don't think God has a sense of humor, just look around. See what I mean? Now, the wonderful revolution that's going on that you and I are part of is that all over this country, and more so around the world, or less, but still to some degree around the world, these uglies, these dregs, the people who you hope don't move in next door, are not only getting over the dysfunction that's in their life. They're not only not overeating or gambling or behaving compulsively or drinking or drugging. They're getting spiritual. And the general public doesn't have a clue that that's going on. And they're getting spiritual in a wonderful kind of way. Most of you know that I'm a Catholic priest. And some of you wonder why. So do I, a lot. But it appears that a day at a time, that's what God has wanted me to be up to this point. And, you know, it's not all that bad. I enjoy it, and it's a privilege, and it has some problems associated with it, too, but so is everything else. People feel sorry for me sometimes. Say, oh, that must be a hard life. I found a lot harder one. I know a tougher job description than being a priest, and that's to be a parent. And there are a lot of you who are parents. And I know something about your parenting. You know, you blew it. Nobody ever gets that one right. And even if you decide to have more children because you're getting better at it, the new kids don't know about those other rules, you know. And you have to. They just don't behave like the first ones did. So you have to start all over again. But life is like that. Life is full of problems and challenges and uncertainty. And it's wonderful that we can get together and share our weakness, strength, and hope. Because our experience really is a history or a catalog of our weakness in our lives. So wouldn't it be nice, and it already is because you participate in it, that we spend our time not so much at looking at the faults of ourselves or other people, but being aware of them and helping people get up and move on again. Because everyone in here makes mistakes, and we're going to make some more mistakes. I can give you some painful things to think about. A great discussion topic at a meeting would be, what will my next compulsion be? A lot of people say, good grief, there's enough pain thinking about the ones I got. Or what will be my next mistake? I mean, it's fun to kind of plan these things, not just let them happen. Then you can be more aware and enjoy it while it's going on, you know? Because mistakes aren't all that bad. What I'm really doing is making a case for weakness, for incompleteness, for not being God. Because those who think they are godly or righteous or have it together or who know it all are basically boring and out of it, and they miss out on life. Life is for living. And all those other ways are traps or ways to get off the path. So, we've got this big secret. And the secret is that we're getting better and we're getting closer to God. Now let's talk about God. There are a lot of people who are scared to death of God. And I don't blame them, because they listen to some other people talk about God who have tried to play God and hurt people a great deal because of that. And they've made God in their own either self-righteous or punishing image, which is a reflection of our own self-hatred and unacceptance of ourselves in this beautiful world, in this wonderful humanity that's full of mistakes, that's been given to all of us. So really, when a person comes to recovery from alcoholism or any of the other things we've been talking about, they have no idea what they're going to get involved in, because their whole focus is on the pain in their life and on the chemical, and what they get instead is the joy of living. And what they get instead is spirituality. And what they get instead is self-acceptance, acceptance of others, all kinds of wonderful things. I have a bookmark that I'd lost for a while. I finally recovered it. It simply says this: joy is the most infallible sign of the presence of God. I believe that. Joy is the most infallible sign of the presence of God. Joy is more than happiness. It's more than euphoria. It's more than a good feeling. Joy is an excitement and an enthusiasm and a positive outlook on life. And everything that alcoholism stands for tries to tear that down and erode and corrupt it. And it does that very well. But you and I live at a time when we know that alcoholism exists, that people who have that particular problem can not only recover or get over that problem, they seem to grow beyond it. And we have to, in order to stay sober and to have any amount of serenity. And I like a lot of serenity. Serenity isn't the absence of conflict. It's being okay in the midst of it, whether there's conflict or not. To have an okayness and a confidence and a joy regardless of what's going on. And some of you have met people with a lot of problems who are joyful, joy-filled. And you know what I'm talking about. There's a man who a lot of you know who I'm very close to, who's dying right now. His name is Bill Eden. And I really get upset to watch Bill die this slow, painful, cancerous death. But I always get cheered up when I go, I forget to be mad after a while, because he's able to give me something that I need, that I didn't know I needed until he gave it to me. And he hardly has any strength left, you know. But second nature with him now, he can communicate that. Had a wonderful experience. Not, I guess I was involved in around program for a little while, and there was a brand new gal. She's about 30, 35, high-powered, bubbly. She's the typical hard-charging businesswoman who got things done, action-oriented. And she realized that the 12 steps involved in AA and Al-Anon and programs like that deal with spirituality. So she thought that some of us who've been around for a while, or some of us who go to church a lot, had a head start. And there'd been no background in her life that she could connect with it. She'd never been in a church. She didn't know anybody in her family who'd ever been in a church. That was her idea of where you got spirituality. So she was hungry, and she would just pester you, and she'd ask you all kinds of questions that were embarrassing, that nobody else had the courage to ask. And I was like, one time she just looked me right in the face and says, "Do you believe in God?" Nobody else ever had nerve enough to ask me that. Try that one sometime. You know, when things get dull at the party, that'll liven things up. You know, and if you really do, and you're really embarrassed about it, I wonder why. And I guess, at least in my cases, I don't have that as integrated as I would like to. I separate God from parties or party talk. After a meeting one night, I was in the kitchen doing the dishes. I go back before styrofoam cups, my God. You know. We were washing the cups and the ashtrays, and she came up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Gavin, if you had to describe God in one word, what would it be?" And I was preoccupied. I didn't have time to think, and I said, "Sneaky." And And then this enormous wave of guilt hit me and almost knocked me over. To say a terrible thing like that. If I would have had time, I would have said loving or compassionate or forgiving, or had a lot of time, I'd say omnipotent or some philosophical thing like that. But I didn't have time, and I just kind of responded spontaneously from my gut, and I said sneaky. And today, if you ask me to describe God in one word, I would say sneaky. Because I really believe that God is sneaky. And I say that not irreverently, I say that with a great deal of respect and affection. Perhaps in the Old Testament days, he sent angels to be his messengers. And he sent an elephant to get my attention. Now, that's real bizarre. But it got my attention. And it got me here, and it got me with you people, and it got me to recovery. I think God knows so much. My experience tells me this, not the theory that I heard from other people or read in books. That God has a way of getting your attention. And he's patient. But he will make himself known and present to all of us in ways that are irrefutably real. And they always happen when we're busy and preoccupied and don't have time. It's just like when people call for help. Have you noticed that? It's too bad we can't schedule 12 step calls ahead of time. You know. Then that gets back to the controlling part of us. You know, we'd like to schedule our crises. Order an orchestra with a lot of violins to accompany them, you know, if we had time. So, back, that's really control again, and control is trying to play God, and control is the enemy of spontaneity, which is the joy, the basis of joyfulness. Sneaky. I really believe God's sneaky. Let me share something else now that you know that wheelbarrow story. And the punchline to that is get back in a wheelbarrow. You know, every now and then I get real screwed up and I tell my friends, oh, it's never been this bad before and I don't know what to do. And usually they'll say, get back in a wheelbarrow. You know, trust what you believe in. And when you do that, things get wonderful. My mother passed away a year ago, and at that time she lived in Indiana. And I insisted on staying in her apartment the two nights that I was back there. And that horrified the relatives, because they are typical Indiana, let's not have any feelings around here type of middle America, conservative. My sister knows what she's doing 7 o'clock Tuesdays the rest of her life. You know, the whole thing is kind of like that. Anyway. They decided they weren't going to have an open casket or any kind of a big service or anything, and I blew that wide open, and because they didn't want to show any feelings. So we had all that, and they all cried and thought it was great, because it was wonderful. Nobody gave them permission to do that in a long time. But it was good for me to stay in that house or the apartment where my mother had lived, because I kept waking up and rummaging around and looking at things and all kinds of memories. But the second night, it was a little tough, and for some reason, I was having a hard time with it. And you know how much that wheelbarrow story means to me and how many times I've told it and the impact that that has on me, because I really have a character defect. Maybe you could do it, describe it in one or two words, but let me use more words to describe it. What it really has to do with is I'd rather think about life and analyze it than live it. And like my friend Terry, who in the face of alcohol claims that it never made him happy, it gave him the illusion that in about 10 minutes he was going to be happy. I live my life this way. I'm not really happy today, but give me 2 or 3 more days to get it figured out, and then I'll be all right. And I figure my way out of character defects, or I think I can. I don't really recall ever having done that. But that's a trap and an illusion that I fall victim to often. Anyway, I went for a long walk to get tired. It didn't work. And I sat down in my mom's favorite chair, and I just asked God to please help me get some peace in my life so I could go to sleep that night. And I found a photo album that I didn't know my mom had, and I'm looking through pictures of the family way back then, and you know, memories are jiggling loose and all kinds of feelings, and it's wonderful. A lot of pictures of my dad who I hadn't thought about or hadn't known that pictures of him in certain situations existed, and it was great. And then I got to a point in that album where there were some pictures I'd never seen before, and one of them was this. It was the picture of Margaret, my sister, and I. Margaret was probably 2 or 3, and I would be 2 or 3 years older at that time. And we're sitting in a wheelbarrow. And my father is holding the wheelbarrow. And when I saw that picture, I knew everything was going to be okay. Because how many times I've shared that story about trusting our Heavenly Father. Look around. There are a lot of times in life when you need to get from here to there and you can't do it on your own. So you look around for who has the power and you trust Him. And you sit quietly in the wheelbarrow and you enjoy the ride. That's what you do. And there's my dad holding the wheelbarrow. Now there's a little more to the story too. It's amazing. I didn't know the picture existed, but I recognized my sister and I recognized my dad and I recognized that wheelbarrow. And then I realized I used to play with that wheelbarrow a lot. And I'm unaware that I've had this thing about wheelbarrows all my life, but I have. It's kind of interesting to realize how the real meaning with wheelbarrows came with that story about belief and faith. And yet I'd kind of been set up for it most of my life. And it's kind of like a time warp. Anyway, prior to my mother's death, about 2 weeks before, I was reading a book on Jungian psychology, which may or may not interest you, but I have a little interest in that area. And it was talking about symbolism that you have in dreams. And they seem to have archetypical, standardized symbolic meaning for people of all races or languages or nations. And they were defining or describing what some of the symbolism means. And I remember clearly it talked about light. And light very often in dreams represents fatherhood or creation or sustaining in creation. And when the photograph was made of my father holding the wheelbarrow with my sister and I in it, either when the photograph was taken or when it was printed, there was a light leak. So it's an incomplete print. And where my father's face should be, there's nothing but light. And in an instant, that whole thing had meaning to me. Sad part about the story is I lost the picture. And I don't know why. About a week ago, I was really fouled up about a whole lot of things. I would hate to have anybody here use me an example of sanity or balance or anything. You know, I've been sober almost 18 years, but I still get so fouled up, I have to ask people what to do and yell help. And I have a favorite line that I hear echoing about every 6 months. It's never been this bad before. And when I hear that echoing off the walls, I recognize, if nothing else, a pattern. And then I kind of go on automatic pilot. I call somebody, and even though I don't want to, because this is different, I tell them about it, and things get better. Anyway, a week ago, I found the picture again. So, you know, just when I needed to know that I wasn't in charge. I want to make a slide out of it to show it to you, and I didn't have time to do that, so sometime during the retreat I'll pass it around, but, you know, I really want that one back. Yeah, God is sneaky. He has ways of getting our attention, and what happens with the way that He gets our attention is to let us know that it's okay to participate in life, and yet so much of what is conventional or ordinary or agreed on just really doesn't seem to apply to us. And what that really means is that internally, it's okay to have your own value system. Not that you're an exception or that you're so retarded and weird and ugly that we need to do a different set of rules for you. But that much of what you've learned and been taught just doesn't apply, because the reality is so much bigger than the way you've heard about it. And what you do is you start internalizing some values and a morality in your own life that becomes very, very real and very personal. And it has meaning only to you, because I really believe that God reveals himself in small things. An example of that would be this wheelbarrow story. I usually don't like to read to people at any great length, but because you're interested in spirituality, there is one thing that I would like to share. And it's from a book called Prayers by Michael Quast. He says, if we only knew how to listen to God, we would hear him speaking to us, for God does speak. He speaks through his gospels. He also speaks through life, that new gospel to which we ourselves add a page each day. But we're rarely open to God's message because our faith is too weak and our life too earthbound. To help us listen, then, at the beginning of our new intimacy with God, let us imagine what he would say if he were here today speaking to us. So, routine is what is such a mixed blessing, because routine and habit helps us do a lot of things that we do automatically that, thank God, we don't have to spend time thinking about. You open that door when you want to get out of here, you don't think about it. You don't have to say, well, let's see, there's a knob on the right hand. I think what you do is you put your hand on that and turn it in a clockwise direction and then push it. You don't have to go through that whole thing. You just know how to do it and you do it. Thank God. But there's so many other things in our life that are really important that we'd like to reflect on and know about that become habitual, that shouldn't be that way. And the prime example of that is relationships. You know, whatever it is we value, once we have it, we take it for granted. We do it with spouses. How terrible. You know, it's not uncommon for me, with a counseling background, to query a spouse about their partner and have them respond, well, here's what she thinks, or here's what she believes. And even if the spouse tries to interrupt and say, well, I don't, or I don't believe that anymore, they get vetoed, they get overruled. You know, I've lived with her for 8 years, I know what she thinks. Which is really saying she hasn't had a new idea in 8 years. Everybody should be capable of new ideas at any particular time. You know, around 12-step programs, it's common to pray the Lord's Prayer. Children have a tough time learning the Lord's Prayer because it didn't make any sense. It's bizarre. Thy kingdom come. What's that got to do with anything? And it says, Our Father who art in heaven. The word art is not used as a verb very often. That's a noun, and kids know that. When we think of art, we think of paintings, we think of statues. We don't go around arting or having been arted. And when the kid hears that, Our Father who art in heaven, he automatically thinks that he misheard what was going on. So kids will learn the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father who art in heaven. And if an adult hears them say that, Our Father who art in heaven, they go nuts. My kid's perverted. He's got this crummy theology. Where did that happen? But the neat thing is that the parent suddenly starts thinking about the prayer, Our Father who art in heaven. I wonder what that means. And we do that when people read the fifth chapter or something, and they're new, and they make a mistake. Suddenly we all wake up. Or if someone puts emphasis in a place of something that's real familiar to us. It's hard for us to hear that fifth chapter thing. It's hard for us to hear the just for today's, because we know what's coming next. And every now and then we need to be brought up short. Like recently I heard someone at a meeting read the beginning of that thing, and all he did was change the inflection. What? An order? which speaks... speaks to a lot of our alcoholic grandiosity. Anyway, what the author does here is he takes some literature, happens to be Christian scripture, that a lot of us have heard before. This is a short 3 sentences. Let me read it to you. It's from Mark. They brought children for him to touch, and the disciples scolded them for it. But when Jesus saw this, he was indignant and said to them, Let the children come to me. Do not try to stop them. For the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. I tell you, whoever does not accept the kingdom of God like a child will never enter it. Now, we've heard that before. This author says, suppose Christ in this case, were here today and he wanted to talk to us. He might say something like this: God says, I like youngsters. I want people to be like them. I don't like old people, unless they're still children. I want only children in my kingdom. It has been decreed from the beginning of time. Youngsters, twisted, humped, wrinkled, white-bearded, let me add, ugly. All kinds of youngsters, but youngsters. There's no changing it. It has been decided there's room for no one else. I like little children because my image has not yet been dulled in them. They have not blotched my likeness. They are new, pure, without a blot, without a smear. So when I gently lean over them, I recognize myself in them. I like them because they're still growing, because they're still improving. They're on the road, they're on the way. But with grown-ups, there's nothing to expect anymore. They will no longer grow, no longer improve. They've come to a full stop. It's disastrous. Grown-ups thinking they've arrived. I like youngsters because they're still struggling, because they're still sinning. But because they sin, you understand, not because they sin, you understand, but because they know that they sin and they say so and they try not to sin anymore. But I don't like grown-ups. They never harm anyone, or at least that's what they say. They have nothing to reproach themselves for, at least that's what they say. I can't forgive them. I have nothing to forgive. At least that's what they say. It's a pity, indeed a pity, because it is not true. Alleluia, alleluia. Open all you little old men, all you little old women. It is I, your God, the eternal risen from the dead, coming to bring back the life of a child in you. Hurry, now is the time. I'm ready to give you again the beautiful face of a child, the beautiful eyes of a child. For I love youngsters, and I want everyone to be like them. Now, you paid attention to that one. When I was doing Mark, you all kind of nodded out like you were using something. And the reason is, you've heard the Mark version before, but it's the same message. So, if your prayer life or your spirituality seems to be somewhat dull or boring, bring a little variety into it. Rephrase some of the prayers. Do something different. And then when you go back to the old way or the more familiar way, it'll have even more familiarity with you. Toward the end of my drinking, I went to a psychiatrist who I had a great deal of faith in. I used to send a lot of people to him. At that time, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was crazy. And I figured I was crazy because I kept doing things I didn't want to do. I kept getting better at it, or worse, however that goes. Anyway, one day he and I were having lunch, and we were consulting about 10 or more people that we were both working with at that time, and they knew we were doing this. The technical word for that's staffing, where you get together and share ideas. But he saw I was getting carried away with something. What he saw I was getting carried away with was labeling people. You know how we kind of categorize people by problems and have little pigeonholes for them? And he said, wait a minute, Gavin, don't you see all these people have the same problem? And this guy had made sense before, but now he's in Looney Tune land. Because they sure had different problems. There was an alcoholic who couldn't quit drinking. There was a guy who beat his kids up, slapped them around, and he didn't want to do it, and he kept going back and doing it, and he didn't understand how that happened. There was a woman who washed her hands every 20 minutes, who took 6 or 8 showers a day. She had a phone in the shower. She was there a lot. When she went on a trip, she packed water and soap so that as they travel along, she could wash her hands. She really wanted to stop washing her hands, but didn't know how. And we're talking about these folks, and he said, don't you see they all have the same problem? And I didn't see that. And then he said this beautiful piece of truth. It's just one sentence. He said, yeah, people who argue with the truth get sick. People who argue with the truth get sick. I believe that. Many of the ways that we get sick are just presenting symptoms of the way that we argue with the truth. And when I first started becoming aware of this, I took it very lightly, but there's a lot of truth in psychosomatic illnesses, which most of us kind of dismiss and laugh about and pass off because say, well, it's just in the person's head. That's not true. It's in their body, too. It started in their head, but they're just as sick, or they're just as dysfunctional. So a good inventory question would be, how do I argue with the truth? How am I arguing with the truth today? A very painful inventory question for you right now, if you really want to be adults and pray for the courage, is what is it in my life that I am pretending not to know? That'll ruin your whole day right there. What am I pretending not to know? And boy, a lot of us get into a lot of that. Acceptance is an important part of the program. And basically what acceptance is not arguing with the truth. Let me give you an example of how to do that. Michael Quast, in that little piece of literature that I read and somewhat paraphrased as I did, is making the point that God loves youngsters. But doesn't have anything to do with age. You know, Ruth in the back is, she's older than God. But she's very much a youngster. And has been ever since I've known her, because she's open and enthusiastic, and she's interested in what's going on today, not replaying what happened yesterday or last week or 20 years ago. So it's being young in that age. Now, I'll tell you a way that most of you argue with the truth. And it's just a three-letter word. It's called age. You brought one with you. And I don't know what your age is, but I know what mine is. I'm 49. And I'd like to be a lot younger in a lot of ways. When I was real young, I wanted to be older real quick. There's a great resentment for you. There was some time in your life when you had it just right and you didn't even notice. So, yeah, you know how old you are today. I don't, but you do. And however old that is, wouldn't it be great if you just accepted that and enjoyed it? And there are a lot of things that could have happened a long time ago that didn't, and that's okay because you have the opportunity to live your life now. I wouldn't want to be a teenager today. It was a lot easier when I did it. And there's some things I'd just soon not go through twice. You know, kids have some real tough choices today, and they don't have a whole lot of information to base their decisions on that's very objective or balanced. You know, I think I had a better chance than that. Wherever you are, be there. People who argue with the truth get sick. Let go and let God. I really believe God exists. I really believe He loves you. And He's given you life, not just 49 years ago or however many years it's been. But He wants to give you life today. And if you accept it and embrace it and live life today, then wonderful things happen. Not the least of which is an awareness that there is a God who loves you, who sends angels or wheelbarrows or someone from central office or God forbid, uglies that carry a message of meaning and healing and love. And you and I have access to that. We can invite it into our life. The more we empty ourselves of our old ideas, the more we stop arguing with the truth, the more that we're willing to share freely with each other.